Hello and welcome to the Parent Survival Kit podcast, from surviving to thriving in your household. My name is Gene Schwellen. Next to me, laughing as always, on camera today, is my beautiful bride, Dr. Sonia Schwellen, pediatric expert psychologist, nationally certified school psychologist. And today we have a very special guest returning once again, Melissa Bloom. She is an expert registered dietitian, nutrition expert. She has all the information about mood and food, mind and gut. We're going to talk about today. So, you know, I know that one of the biggest conversations we have all the time in our families is, what's for dinner? I don't know, honey. What are you in the mood for? Oh, I don't know. So mood and food kind of all go together, right?
They do.
Depending on what mood we're in, may determine what food we want to eat or not.
Yeah, and is there science behind that?
I don't know. So let's.
So
let's
Melissa, find out. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about who you are and what your background is, and then we'll jump in.
Hey, awesome. Hi, my name's Melissa Bloom. I am a certified eating disorder registered dietitian, and my background is primarily in eating disorders. I've had some history with working with those undergoing bariatric surgery, and food and mood is one of my top favorite topics to talk about because there's so much to learn and so much that goes into it that most people have no idea the connection between your brain and your gut.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I mean, there's commercials out there, Snickers, are you hangry, and all these things that go on. So tell us, let's let you dive into this mood, food, mind, gut connection. And
yeah, absolutely. So I think as a parent, it's really important to remember this for your kiddos when they do get hangry, or if they struggle with any kind of anxiety or depression, and understanding the role of nutrition. So our gut is known as our second brain. So it also has the fancy name of the enteric nervous system that communicates with your actual brain, the one that we think of. So if you think about it, there's all kinds of communication pathways between our brain and our gut. A lot of people don't know that our gut can be as unique as our own thumbprint. So everyone's different in their gut microbiota and their gut bacteria. Your gut has about 4 to 5 times the amount of neurons firing compared to your brain, having about 100 neurons. So your gut is arguably more active in improving or changing your mood.
Wow. So you said the gut microbiota?
The gut microbiota. So everyone kind of knows it as probiotics and prebiotics. Those are the products that help grow your bacteria in your gut. That's what microbiota means. It's that, it kind of sounds weird, but that community of different types of bacteria in your gut. And some people have healthier guts than others in terms of bacteria, and anxiety, depression, things that we suffer with from a mental health perspective absolutely affect the health of your gut. Nutrition plays a role in improving the health of your gut, which then can improve your mood.
All right. So we need to have different types of microbiota. Mm-hmm, and whatnot. Yep. And the more we have, the better we are.
Yeah. So the balance of good and bad bacteria, a lot of the times I'm saying probiotics because as a parent, you think of, do my kids need pro or prebiotics? And those help build the good bacteria. And there's certain types of foods that can't improve your mood unless you're hangry and you're just hungry, improve your mood immediately. But over time, building that positive good bacteria in your gut can help improve mood.
So when we see those different types of foods or milks that say, you know, there's probiotics in it, prebiotics, those types of things, those are good or?
Yeah, they're not going to be quite as beneficial for your gut as, say, maybe a fermented food. Like, I don't know if anyone has ever seen the kefirs, the little yogurt probiotic drinks. But yogurts naturally have probiotics and prebiotics in them. Things like sauerkraut, a German thing. Some people like it, some people don't. and kombucha, things that products, even cereals, granolas have added pro and prebiotics because of the popularity. Those aren't going to be as beneficial as consuming something that naturally has pro and prebiotics like a yogurt, a kefir, a kombucha, things like that.
So when we see things about the probiotics and the live cultures and whatnot, what, yes. What does that mean?
Live cultures are that actual living strains are in the food. So there's like lovely little bacteria minions like running around in the food.
So like from natural foods and whatnot, that's going to be where we actually get the live cultures from, yes. Like the yogurts and the sauerkraut, yes. And the, yes. Other word you said.
Yes, kombucha. Kombucha. things like kimchi, like Korean fermented types of foods too, can help build our good bacteria in our gut because they have pro and prebiotics. So also, I think in terms of stress, so if someone's really undergoing a lot of stress in their lives, even as a kiddo, that in turn has been shown to decrease the good bacteria in your gut as well. So reducing stress, going to therapy, handling anxiety and depression are really important for building that gut bacteria too.
That's awesome. So yeah. I know there's been a lot of research and I couldn't give any information. So that's why we have you here today. But mm-hmm. When you talk about stress and depression and whatnot, from what I understand, there's actual foods that we can also eat. Obviously, there's other things like mm-hmm. therapy that are definitely very important.
Yep.
But there are certain foods, from what I understand, that we can actually put into our body that actually can help, I guess, navigate or whatnot the stress or depression we may be experiencing.
Yeah, it goes both ways. So our mood can improve our gut, and our gut health can improve our mood. So along with fermented or probiotic-rich foods, things that are primarily plant-based, so they're called polyphenols, so they're plant compounds, have been shown to improve gut health. So like... I love saying cacao instead of cocoa. I think it's fancy and it's great. Things like nuts and seeds, any kind of fibrous, cruciferous vegetable like broccoli, cauliflower, things that are fairly colorful or where the polyphenols are coming from. Things like even certain teas and tannins, which is an antioxidant in tea, can help improve your gut, primarily plant-based products.
Okay. So
yeah.
When a girl goes through a major breakup or whatnot, and she's got that tub of ice cream, not really so helpful. Maybe if it's a tub of frozen yogurt.
Yes, if it's actual yogurt, uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it's okay to indulge in things, but on a biological level, it's probably not going to long-term improve our mood.
All right.
I love it. It's awesome.
All right, so what other types of mood food little tricks and tips do you have for us?
Well, I have some fun facts that I forgot to say at the beginning. A lot of people don't know that serotonin, which is a hormone neurotransmitter that improves our mood and can make us feel calm, 80% of that is produced in our gut. So you have to wonder if our gut isn't to the point where we need it to be, and it's microbiota, good and bad bacteria, that affects our release of serotonin. And then also, there's a lovely, neurotransmitter named GABA that also helps, with mood that is made in the gut. And then short chain fatty acids, which our gut produces, actually helps with appetite, and learning some of those hunger and satiety cues. So it's interesting how many things can come from our gut.
Yeah, so it sounds like our gut really has a mind of its own, and
yeah,
we can...
No pun intended.
Yeah. So I want to add, because a lot of times when, you know, we just talked to a psychiatrist, you know, in a previous episode about medications and side effects, and a lot of times with psychotropic medications, those are the ones like antidepressants and things like serotonin reuptake inhibitors that are prescribed. A common side effect to that is nausea. And so, you know, if you make that connection, if a lot of our receptors are actually in our gut and then we're taking a medication that has to do with that neurotransmitter, We're going to feel it in our stomach or in our gut more than we're going to feel it in our brain first.
Yeah.
So it's just a way that I usually will explain why these are such common side effects with these medications, mm-hmm. because we're actually affecting the neurotransmitters or the receptors in our gut more in the beginning when you first yep. start taking a medication like that than you are affecting your brain.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think to grasp to the concept between our mood and food and our gut and our mind being connected is if we go and publicly speak somewhere, a lot of times people have the anxiety and the butterflies and they're going to have issues in the bathroom, not TMI. And so that is a direct mental change that goes into our gut. And so if we think about it, yeah, they are connected. Well, it makes sense.
Let's actually just put the words out there because I think it helps. Because we've had so many conversations, you know, even me and you together, with clients who have come into our clinic and we talked to them about, well, have you noticed that when, you know, what you're saying is that you kind of have diarrhea when you're really, really anxious. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought that those two could be connected? And there's so many times when clients are like, I've never made that connection until right now because you pointed that out to me.
Well, I remember when I walked into Melissa's office one day when she was at Next Steps, there was this laminated sheet and I was so fascinated by it. It happened to be sitting on her desk and I don't even know.
It's the Bristol stool chart.
Yeah. Right? So it had all the different types of stools that you have or you experience depending on, you know, if you're dehydrated or if you're anxious or if this or if that. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. So I can figure out what's wrong with me right now by looking at my stool. You know, that's a good tool.
Uh-huh. There you go. You're in a goofy mood today.
I love it. You can figure out if your poop is normal. The Bristol stool chart is actually a legitimate tool. If you go Google it, it's funny, the description. It's just a side note.
So you really should. You should go Google the Bristol stool chart mm-hmm. and examine it, look at it and whatnot, because I mean you can find out a lot about yourself pretty quickly and then you have the tools you need to go get some things and make some changes.
Make a self-assessment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we love those things, man. Forget WebMD, man. We've got it. Bristol stool chart. There you go.
Well, so but what we were saying is, you know, clients are blown away sometimes when they make the realization that being anxious and maybe having diarrhea or GI issues, whatever they may be, are connected. It's news to them.
Yes. And a lot of the times we will connect like or blame food for those issues. And really most of the time that would not be the case. So when you can make that connection, anxiety management tools you can use to manage your anxiety actually help your gut. So
and in little kids, I mean, because we're talking to parents, so we're talking about little kids, we're talking about teenagers, you know, a lot of times kiddos and even teens will let us know that they are experiencing some kind of mood symptom based on a physical symptom that they're having. And many times it's a tummy ache mm-hmm. or it's nausea, diarrhea, constipation, something like that that could be going on. And it could very much be related to a psychological issue that they're feeling, you know, I always say they're feeling their feelings in their body. And in this case, they're feeling their feelings in their gut. And like you said, I mean, we see it all the time. And, you know, where parents and even kids will blame a food group or they'll start an elimination diet or something because it's like every time a kid eats this food, they get nauseous. And we kind of miss even assessing for anxiety or depression when really that could be what's causing the GI issues.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. I mean, you know, I had a procedure done at the dermatologist a few weeks ago, and he told me, you're going to feel this in your gut, you know, and it had nothing to do with my gut. And then if you think about, like, all these things that happen sometimes, like if there's a really traumatic experience, it's gut-wrenching, right? Mm-hmm. All these things we feel in our gut, you know, what's your gut tell you? You know, I mean, all these things that we have.
It's
but
that gut feeling, I just know, right?
When you fall in love with me, huh?
Right. The butterflies are flying.
Yeah, it's really phenomenal how much our gut does tell us if we just listen to it, you know. And we've talked about this on other shows, episodes about even when kids are a baby and we keep feeding them when they're like, no, I don't want any more. But we keep trying to force it. And then we potentially over time screw up their just their internal, you know, tickers that tell us when we're full or not. So,
yeah. I think going when you're having, and even asking your kiddos this, if they are having GI distress or issues there, the first question or thought process as a parent should go to what's going on mentally for them or what could be. And that's kind of your first process of elimination and figuring out the problem.
Ooh, yeah. I like that. That's a great rule of thumb.
Well, I was going to say the chicken
from
the neck.
You wouldn't expect a dietitian to say that. I'm sorry.
No.
That's cool that you're thinking like that.
Yep.
That's yeah, that chicken from the neck up, the assessment we've talked about in the past. And it's so easy. It's very, it's not invasive. I mean, going to a GI doctor can be really scary. I mean, I don't even want to know what they do in the appointments and all the things they have to go through. But as a kid, I mean... Yeah. That's like a serious doctor with the white lab coat that I'm going to be scared of rather than going to see if it may be something else first.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really great point. Cause usually when you go the medical route, there could be blood work that's needed and labs and tests and needles and, you know, the whole association with going to a doctor. And usually that's the route most parents will go first, is like a medical, they go down the medical rabbit hole. You know, we tested for I usually see kids and parents by the time they've already tested for everything. I hear that all the time. We've done everything and there's no medical explanation for this. And then they finally end up at my door. Yeah. But it's very interesting to think of. Maybe the first question we should be asking is what's going on with our child, either mentally or emotionally, as a way to explain this first.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we know that every kid's dealing with anxiety and depression, you know, to some level. You know, some kids can manage it better than other kids, and it may not be as severe with some kids and other kids and whatnot, but, you know, it's definitely out there. So definitely it's a lot easier to take that, to rule out anything mental health first than it is anything medical. So,
yes.
We're not just saying it's all in our head, because now we're saying it's just all in your gut. So why don't you give us a little bit of like a little bit more education about the gut brain access and tell us what that even means?
So the gut brain or the brain gut axis.
I said it backwards. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. It's interchangeable. Yeah. Okay, it's both ways. So it's really, that's a term to describe the way that the gut and the brain connect, and they do that through the vagus nerve, which also regulates hunger and fullness cues. I know I keep saying that. And then neurotransmitters, as well as your immune system. So that's a whole nother topic. Your gut actually harbors a lot of your immunity as well, but your brain communicates through different pathways to your gut and vice versa. So neurotransmitters, you think of dopamine, serotonin, which also act as hormones. Those are a part of the neurotransmitters that do communicate. Same thing with other kinds of hormones like leptin and ghrelin, which again, do regulate our appetite cues too. So I think that's a little bit of a separate topic with food and mood, but they connect that way all through the gut to the brain and vice versa.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ghrelin's when you're hungry, leptin's when you're full.
Think ghrelin, grr. That's how I remember it.
That's why I knew that, because yeah. You taught me that.
So speaking of like the healthy and not healthy bacteria in the gut and whatnot, are we supposed to have good and bad bacteria in the gut? I mean, is that normal?
Yes. So, again, different factors can affect that. I think genetics affect it, environment affect it, mental health, like we just talked about, affects it. Nutritional patterns absolutely can affect it. And so having a balance of positive and negative bacteria is optimal. I think a lot of people, just with the amount of stress alone that we endure and have endured over the past now almost, well, a year and a half, I'm going to say 2 years, it feels like that, 5 years, that arguably those shifts have probably happened more often now than they had in the past. Now, I think the other question goes, a popular question that I get is, should I take probiotics in pill form to help balance my good and bad bacteria or positive and negative bacteria? And the answer is maybe. It's not clear cut, because we have billions of strains in our gut of good and bad bacteria, and probiotics maybe have 5. strains of living bacteria and are they actually living? There's some questions there. So the question is that if you take a probiotic, do you need that specific strain found in the probiotic? The answer is 50-50, maybe, you know. So I will say historically, people have said, hey, when I ask them, is a probiotic helping you? And there's so many other factors that could, again, working in mental health, just an improvement in mood. But others will say, no, they didn't make any kind of difference. And so that's, I did some research into that and getting that response, and that's why. Usually you're better taking probiotics in supplement form or pill form is what I mean. With the more strains, the better, because the better chance you have at getting a strain you need.
So it sounds like a crapshoot.
Yeah, it is.
Is there a test to find out what your gut flora is like?
I had that question asked a little while ago, and I'm sure there are tests, but not tests that are being done regularly.
Okay. So that makes me even wonder, because I know so many parents, and I have conversations with many, you know, other moms, like just in passing, even at church, about the holistic doctor that they're going to see now because their child's behavior, their child's anxiety, you know, they didn't want to go the traditional route or they've found failure with the traditional route. And so they're going this route and the holistic doctor is prescribing all different kinds of probiotics, but there's no test. And so ultimately that doctor's also guessing,
yes,
maybe throwing a kind of throwing that, like casting that wide net and doing kind of what you're mentioning, which is just prescribe a bunch of the more strains, the better. Mm-hmm. And just there's hopefully some benefit here.
See if it works.
Okay.
Hopefully it's beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, that's important to know because the holistic route, it, like, there's value there. There's obviously pros and cons. I've just met so many families who have literally put their children on very restrictive diets, are convinced up and down that their holistic doctor knows exactly what they're talking about. I mean, almost worships the provider.
Yes.
You know, and ultimately it's important to know that even though they might be running some tests or they're trying to put data to all of this, that we're still not advanced scientifically enough to actually put data to this.
Yeah. There's no way of knowing what strain someone's missing or needs more of by,
very interesting.
Yeah, by taking a stool sample or looking at someone or saying their symptoms. It's more just like everything, nutrition and body, it's more complex than what it seems.
Well, and even if you have some tests, it would seem just natural that you'd have to do like tests like a couple of times a day, morning, night,
yeah,
and several times a week to really get a true understanding of really where everything's at, because what you're putting in your body daily changes, mm-hmm, and what your body needs one day versus another day depends on brain activity, physical activity, sure, so many other things.
Stress,
too.
Like just
stress,
the day.
Yeah.
You know, maybe one day your child has a test and so they're much more stressed out that day, and we know that stress impacts all of this. And then the next day, because the test is out of the way, they're feeling much better. They're laid back, or it's the weekend, right? So it's a completely different scenario. And the stress in the environment or the stress of the circumstances is absolutely going to impact anxiety levels, depression levels, and even what's going on in the gut.
Yes. And I think also this may be a harder concept to grasp, but if your kiddo is saying, I'm really stressed, I have some anxiety, they're not saying that, but I'm really stressed, and I don't feel well in my stomach, I think our gut instinct is to go to, there's a lot of puns, can go to, well, okay, then my child doesn't need to eat. But in reality, is it related to the food itself? Or is it the anxiety? Probably the stress and the anxiety, not the food. So eating may actually help soothe their stomach versus just avoiding food because they don't feel well.
I'm really glad you brought that up, and I want to just talk about that a little bit more because I see it all the time in the recovered clinic, which is our eating disorder specialized clinic. But I see it in the general side also. The exact thing is, you know, my child doesn't have an appetite. They say they're nauseous. They're never hungry for breakfast. They kind of feel sick in the morning. They don't want to eat. They have all the reasons for continuing to not eat, even though we know that from even just this conversation, that food is so important for balancing our gut, for giving us the boost that we are looking for on a neurotransmitter level.
Yep.
Well, and I was going to say earlier also, I mean, just a variety of foods, eating a variety of foods and the different food groups and whatnot is also huge. I mean, that teaches your gut certain things as well.
Yeah.
When we were talking about the probiotics, one thing that I wanted to mention is that that's a whole new, brand new, big industry altogether now as well. I mean, we talked about probiotics a while back, and I was Googling it through Google and even Amazon and what's out there, and there's so many different things that you can get for probiotics and how many strands this has, how many live cultures this
is. It refrigerated or is it shelved?
Is it powder form or is it pill form? I mean, there's so many choices out there that, I mean, I just gave up. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to get it from whatever I get it from. And if I don't get it, I don't get it. And, you know, is it going to really work or not going to work? Is it going to, you know, if it's pill form, does it really help you because it's not live? I mean,
sure.
So I was like, you know what? I'm not going to spend the money on it because it's also very expensive when you look at it. So,
yeah, a lot of times, you know, things, and I think you'll see this more in gut health because that term will be caught by marketing and larger businesses just to make money. And so a lot of the times the marketing and the product comes before the actual research is done, and it tries to make things more simplified for us. But in the end, they want us to buy the product.
So let's talk about, I got a couple of questions that I think everyone really wants to know. So I've got some friends that are very athletic. They're on the tennis team with me and whatnot. And so they like to cleanse. And they'll do a cleanse like once a quarter. And their cleanse is actually, or a couple of the guys actually do a, like a fast for like 1 week. And they have like the soup that they eat and then just water, and that's all they do for an entire week, and they fast. They feel like it cleans their gut and everything else out. They feel a lot lighter. They feel like more focused and tuned, and everything changes. So there's that, and that I want you to kind of speak on. And then the other fasting that I hear on the radio all the time are not fasting, but these other cleanses are these juice cleanses. You can order them by 3 o'clock today and you'll have them on your porch tonight. You drink these cleanses and everything is better. Have you heard those? I mean, it's insane. It's all over Kiss FM right now. I mean, these cleanses, these juice cleanses.
Yeah. So I think my number one response to cleansing or fasting and detoxing and that idea of flushing out your body is all up in here. It actually doesn't happen on a scientific level. There is no evidence-based research to support the idea of flushing out your system. You have a kidneys, ideally. You have a liver. You have lungs, actually. That gets rid of toxins if you think about it environmental. And we have those things for us. Now, it's different eating, you know, eating a well-balanced, variable diet. That's different than when maybe we've eaten a non-variable diet for the week before, right? That's different than going and flushing out our system in that concept. I feel like it's all a placebo. I feel like that is a quick fix for something that really isn't based in research whatsoever.
It's not sustainable.
No.
Well, and I had a good friend.
I like that placebo.
I had a really good friend that used to once a month, at least once a month, do the magnesium citrate, you know, cleanse and whatnot. I'm like, that is just, you go ahead with that, but So what you're saying is that God made the perfect organs that does all the things that He designed, and who's going to question what He designed, right? So let your body work.
Yes, and you can trust those things. Obviously, if you have, you know, kidney issues and you need to be on dialysis, right? That's the whole point of detoxifying our blood, because our kidneys aren't working like they should for different reasons. Your body will detox itself.
Well, and I think the argument that we're making is it actually needs food and nutrition in order to do that. So in order to stay well running, like your body's a machine, you're trying to fuel it, you're trying to keep it a well-oiled machine, you have to put the fuel in it.
Well, it's like your car. I mean, you want your car to perform properly, you got to go get gas. If you don't get gas, what happens? That happened to me 2 weeks ago, middle of 35, my car ran out of gas. I had to pull over on the side of the road. You know, that wasn't my fault, it was my son's fault. It's my story, I'm sticking
but,
to it.
You know, the
But you die.
The comparison we're making is in order for your organs and everything to run smoothly, you need to have like the supreme fuel, which is the variety, the regular, consistent, variable diet that you're talking about.
Yes.
You can't just keep putting like subpar stuff in it either.
And right.
That's why we balance. We can, but not all the time. And we should eat other stuff. And it doesn't have to be all the time either. Mm-hmm. It's just that whole moderation and balanced way.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit, I think, because this is when I'm going to do this from personal experience, and I hope there's other people out there that can relate to me. So when I first started in the world of eating disorders, the training, all the experiences I had, with regard to learning about food and nutrition, and I mean, it rocked my world. Okay. Because I, just like all of our audience members out there, are products of society. Okay. And very much I was a product of diet culture, valuing the thin ideal, understanding that I could crash diet here or there to look a certain way. You know, I bought into it as a young woman in my 20s and whatever. And so now that I'm in this field and I've really learned a lot about how diet industry works, and the messages out there are really just money-making schemes, and we're all set up to fail, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's what keeps bringing the money in, keeps us spending money. The basics of nutrition I've never learned them until I started hanging out with dietitians. Nope. So one basic thing that I want you to speak to, which is just so important, I think, is breaking down how food actually has different types of nutrition. What is nutrition? Like vitamins, minerals, is that what it is? Just explicitly say it. And then what our body does with that stuff.
Yeah, well, that's kind of funny you went there, because I was going to ask the same thing. I was going to say there's the major food groups, right? There's four or five, right? So
technically six.
My pyramid has six different colors
so
on it.
So that's why I'm bringing this up, because, and then there's like protein, there's grains.
Yes.
But there's this is not either one. It's a macronutrient. Like, what are these things, and what do we need to really focus on? As far as having a balanced diet, just putting some of these things in. Because I know that if someone educates me, mm-hmm. I'm going to work really hard to put those things in my diet each meal as much as I possibly can.
Yes, yes.
See, but that's more surface. I'm talking about even telling the audience, right? Like, mm-hmm. what actually does our body do with that stuff?
Okay, awesome. So to go a little bit more surfacey at first, we have nutrition to explain it really... is a combination between things that provide us energy, which most people would know as calories. I like to use the word energy because that's what it is. Calories have this negative connotation. I'm going to cut my calories. I need to not eat as many calories. Really what you're saying is replace that word with energy and see how that changes your thought process around that and your tone as well. Anyway, that's a side note. And then nutrition is also a variety of different types of micronutrients like vitamins and minerals. So we have our macronutrients, which provide us energy, also known as carbs, fats, and proteins. And then we have our micronutrients that do not provide us energy, but that help with every function in our body. Gene, to add on to what you were saying, the food groups themselves, like dairy, grains, proteins, fats, what other food groups are there? I don't know. And you have those.
And vegetables.
Vegetables and fruits. There we go.
Oils.
Done. Fats and oils. You have macros and micros in all of those food groups. Okay. So that's why food groups are something that is taught, because you don't have to count carbs. You don't have to count macros. To get what you need, if you eat a variety of food groups, you will get different kinds of macros and micros.
And so essentially all food is a source of nutrition and a source of energy.
Absolutely.
All food.
Absolutely.
So there's no good or bad. It's just energy and nutrition.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's where variety comes in. Like if we have five sodas every day, right? We're not getting a variety of nutrients. We're getting carbs, simplistic carbs. carbs themselves are not bad, but then you go back to the variety. You're not, it's not a, you use the word supreme.
Yeah. Like that. Right. Well, and when you talk about carbs, like people want to get cut carbs and whatnot when carbs are necessary. If you don't get carbs, you can't sustain for a period of time.
Right.
But one thing I've heard, like when I've, you know, when I work out or weight train or when I used to train as an athlete, there was complex and non-complex carbs. What is the difference?
Complex and simple carbs. So complex are literally, we're going to take it down a little bit more to chemistry. Complex carbs have more complexity in their chemical bonds. At its basic level, that's what complex means. It's not good. It's not bad. It's more complex in how it's digested. So if you think about something physically, if it has more bonds, if it has more chemicals in it, then it's going to be harder to break down. So slowing the rate of digestion. Simplistic carbohydrates are those that are more like simple sugars that go almost straight to the bloodstream. They don't have a whole lot of complexity to the chemical structure. So physically, you can digest them very quickly, which is why a type 1 diabetic will consume a fruit juice if their blood sugar's low and not consume a bagel. Bagels are complex carbs. Fruit juices are simple carbs. They go straight to the bloodstream versus the complex carb will take more time.
So after a workout or something, strenuous activity, complex carbs are beneficial because your body needs more of the carbs to be broken down over time to fuel your body.
Complex carbs paired with protein to build muscle. And then the simplistic carbs gives you more of an energy burst. So that would be something to have before a soccer game, before any kind of a tennis match, before working out. Those would be more beneficial to give you that burst of energy. It's like the sugar high, right, that kids get after they have ice cream or soda or whatever. But I was going to actually, when answering your question, Dr. Schwalen, go directly into carbohydrates and just our liver function and actually all different kinds of nutrients. Our liver, is our main detoxifier of foods. So our liver also is the main metabolizer of foods as well. So if you don't have fuel on a biological level to fuel the function of your liver that filters out everything, then how are you going to have the fuel to detox your body with your liver if it's not filtering out the nutrients that it should? So that has a direct connection. The liver is a really important organ when we talk about metabolism and making carbohydrates and usually nutrition stuff. That's what we learn about in the liver. Proteins really, if we're going to talk about the macronutrients, proteins really provide more of a structural function. So if we don't have like muscle helping our heartbeat, if we don't have some of those like enzymatic structures, then our vitamins and minerals can't help the protein carry out its function for creating like our being. That's what I want us to think of proteins as, is like it makes up our structure. It's part of our skin. If we don't have enough protein, we are, the integrity of our body goes down. Same thing with fats. They create a lipid lining and a protective layer. So they're very highly involved in immunity. So if you think about it too, you're going to connect that with your gut. If you don't have a strong immunity, do you have a strong gut? Which then, can you improve your mood? It all is interconnected.
It is.
So it's much more complicated than that. I just like bullet point some of the functions, but food, to your point, food is, it's good for
us.
What's
for dinner?
It's good for us. And you know, when you're talking, I'm having those mind blowing moments that I had even when I first started in this field, because it always happens. It's really cool, you know, that food has all those components to it. It's interesting because we, you know, going to a dietitian, we can learn what different types of foods meet all those components so we can ensure having the variety.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if we're trying to do it on our own, we can just make sure we're eating a little bit of everything every day, right? Eat all the food groups every single day and you pretty much you got it covered. And then it's interesting too, because like when you were talking about complex carbs and simple carbs, you're talking about the bonds between the chemical structure, but nobody knows that a carbohydrate is actually carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. Mm-hmm. That's something they would learn if they came to see you.
Correct.
So that's the chemical structure you're talking about. And then learning about, you know, how to take that chemical structure information and translate it to what actual food meets that on a science level. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so cool. It's so, I'm mesmerized, you know?
It is. Yeah. Thinking about what food can do for us versus what it can't do. There's so many negativity around what food's not to eat.
Yeah.
You know?
Even with carbs and everything else. I mean, you mentioned the fad diets and all that, and you know, you can manipulate your body for a period of time, mm-hmm. but it's not sustainable. And that's why no one ever actually succeeds with these fad diets. They ultimately end up failing. And then when they fail, they end up usually going backwards where they were before. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've learned over the years, just with having new food exposures and eating more vegetables and trying new things, is that, first of all, it's fun. Mm-hmm. But I do take pride in being full of energy and being physical and having a muscular structure that I want, you know, my body and how I look is somewhat important to me. I mean, I take pride in that. I think everyone should take pride in their appearance, whatever that appearance may look like. And so because I do take pride in that, I do take pride in the food that I eat. And so it's easy for me to eat other things and eat more things because there's a purpose. It comes down to ultimately people figuring out really what they really want and what they really don't want. If you really want something, you can achieve it. It may take a little bit longer than this fad diet is advertising, but the long term or the longevity is going to be there. So,
mm-hmm. Yep.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you're saying, I want to make sure we don't misconstrue that because we're talking about being healthy regardless of what size you are. Because I think that's what we're also touching on. And I think parents really struggle with this. Because they'll say things like, you know, I don't want you to eat too much sugar, or I don't want, you know, because either sugar makes you too hyper, sugar makes you crash. So they're talking about the food mood, the gut brain axis, or vice versa. And then they also will say things like, I'm concerned because I don't want them to struggle through life because it could make them overweight or whatever that is. And so, you know, we want to also send the message that if you want high energy, you want to feel good, you want to get through life, you know, in a, I don't know, alert way where you can actually participate in a meaningful way. It's really about nutrition, variety, understanding that you can't deprive your body. You can't cleanse your body. You can't do those things because fuel actually is needed for proper organ function. And it's not just about the outside. It's a lot about what we all really don't understand unless you've studied it and mm-hmm. have a degree in it. About what's going on the inside.
Yeah. Well, and it's one of those things I used to say all the time. I work hard to play hard, you know, and that can mean a whole lot of different things. But even with our foods, I mean, if we work hard at eating a variety of foods and we can play hard at enjoying some of the other things that we really enjoy having, and then it's going to be great. And we even do that mm-hmm. with our kids. Our kids, they have to, you know, eat a variety of foods and try different things, and then they can have dessert, you know, whenever mm-hmm. it's appropriate and whatnot. So it's a reward for them.
Sure.
And it also, you know, helps them try other things.
Yep.
You know, one thing when you mentioned kids, and I think parents really should know this one. So I'm going to kind of link these two if I can. There are certain times, like when we eat something, like we don't really feel that great afterwards. Why is that?
Well, the answer, I don't know.
Okay, so I guess it just depends on.
So it depends upon like some of those things were environment, stress, what's going on? Is it the food itself? You know,
I can give you an example.
Amount?
Yeah, it could be. I guess that makes sense. That's kind of a dumb question, but. One thing that Dr. Swinoff and I realized, we really try to eat as clean as possible. So like really just, you know, fruits, vegetables, meats and whatnot, things that our great grandmother wouldn't consider food and understand mm-hmm. that was food. Whenever we eat fast.
So you mean like we try to cook a lot.
Yeah. We eat at home. Yeah. So yeah. We're, you know, we're using.
Being creative, fresh.
Natural yeah. ingredients, mm-hmm. fresh. Yeah. Fresh, you know, mm-hmm. ingredients and whatnot. When we eat fast food, a lot of times, you know, I'll just speak for myself. Whenever I eat fast food, I don't feel very good afterwards and yeah. whatnot. Is it just because of the processed food and things like that.
Yeah, maybe the way that, you know, I think some people's, it goes back to gut. Some people, if they do consume those types of foods very regularly, maybe their gut might, and this is a theory, maybe their gut microbiota is more set up to handle some of those foods. Now, saying maybe they have more, they don't have as much positive bacteria. I don't know. That's just a thought that comes up to my mind.
Maybe you train your gut to be a certain way mm-hmm. based on what you give it regularly.
Yeah. But also knowing from the fast food standpoint, if you have more, I don't like the word processed because pretty much everything's processed, but highly processed foods are different than like an apple that's sliced that's technically processed. That's a nitpicky verbiage. But highly processed foods, I think, are really the ingredients found in them may be a little bit more challenging for our bodies to digest because it's not something that our bodies typically were made to consume at a certain level. Not that you can't have fast food by any means, but I think being intuitive about the way that you're feeling with certain foods, and it's different if kiddos have eating disorders, right? Because they can feel bad up here, which ultimately makes them feel bad up here, down here. But I think, you know, maybe there is some evidence into training, you know, your gut to digest certain things.
Yeah. Well, and one thing I learned a long time ago is the preservatives that go into fast food to, you know, have a longer sustainable shelf life. And then also even preservatives to preserve the integrity of the food in some ways.
Well, and I think to add to that point, fast food, the whole point of it is convenience. And I think it's changed over the last now 70 years. McDonald's was 1950. I don't know. But I think that part of the reason for that food is not necessarily just fuel. I think that shelf life, there's different purposes that may not provide benefit for your body, but that provide benefit for the fast food industry. True. If that makes sense. So,
do you mind if we, talk a little bit more about like the connection between increasing rates of depression with clients who or patients who are like, they have irritable bowel syndrome, for example. So I want to get kind of more back to the mood food connection.
Yeah.
Because we see that all the time in the nutrition clinic where clients are going through a lot of testing or they're going down the medical route and they're checking for Crohn's or celiacs or IBS. And it comes up so often, but they're also presenting with a lot of anxiety and depression. Is there a link there?
Yeah. So research shows that those who experience anxiety have a higher rate of being diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. It's a pretty catch-all diagnosis.
You mean the GI diagnosis?
Yeah, IBS.
IBS is a catch-all.
Yeah.
It's a way to explain what people really can't explain.
Yes.
Okay.
In my experience, I'm not a GI doctor, but so like if someone has constipation or someone has diarrhea or someone has bloating or GI discomfort and a physician may not be able to figure out what causes that, IBS is typically splat, the label that we put on it. So it makes sense that those with anxiety have a higher rate of experiencing IBS or symptoms like diarrhea, constipation, bloating, stomach discomfort on a more regular basis.
With no medical explanation.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for that. That's very interesting.
Yeah. That's my experience working as a dietitian with almost everyone that comes in with some kind of anxiety, depression, eating disorder, all of the above. That's typically what happens.
Yeah. If you look at that chart that we talked about, then if you have something that's irregular, there's a reason behind it. It's not just IBS.
You can tell a lot by your poop.
It might not be medical. It may be mental. It may be something. But, you know, the last thing I wanted to mention, too, that I think all of us can be guilty of at times as parents, some of us more than others, is talking about children and, like, you know, food, mood and whatnot. we talk about this on a lot of different episodes, but children, things are more caught than taught by children. And I think when it comes to food, variety of foods, how we feel about foods, how we feel after we eat certain foods, I think kids catch a lot of that from parents and whatnot. So is there any advice you give parents when you're talking about children who may just have concerns about eating or eating certain foods or whatnot?
Yeah, I think if I'm understanding correctly, where I would give parental advice is be careful what we attribute specifically to food itself and talk neutral with food, meaning that we said it a few times here, there's really no good and bad food, that it all has a purpose. So being careful with the language around, so for example, if you know your child doesn't feel well after consuming ice cream, you know that that's a lot of sugar. I heard it in Starbucks this morning. You can't have this much sugar in the morning. It'll make you not feel good. And so that may be true, but at the end of the day, then that child connects that specific food ingredient really to not feeling well, which there's a lot more to the picture than that. So I think my advice is really remaining as neutral as you can and not pointing the finger at one certain thing.
Right. Don't blame it on the food. Yeah. Right. Because even like clients with or kids with IBS, for example, you know, parents might be convinced that it's all the cheesy pizza you ate last night and that's why you're having this upset, when really it could be, you know, guilt or shame because they ate something, or, you know, has more to do with what's going on psychologically.
Right.
Than what it actually has to do with the food they ate.
Yes.
Yeah, well, and then and one thing that, you know, I remember one morning, our three-year-old, he was two then, he wanted to get some candy for breakfast out of the pantry and whatnot. And I said, you can't have that. You can't have too much sugar in the morning before you eat breakfast. And Dr. Swain came in there, of course, said, you can't tell him, it's, you know, talking about sugar. And so I said, okay, fine. You know, you talk to him about why he can't have candy and how he needs to have breakfast first. And she tried for about 10 minutes and she lost the battle. She ran out the kitchen. She goes, fine, you handle it. And so I was stuck there handling it. But, you know, these conversations, if we're really being very intentional about how we talk about food, then the proper response would be, okay, well, we actually need to have breakfast first because we need to have a variety of different food groups. And maybe we should all as parents, because we are parents and we have kids and food's going to be a necessity. Mm-hmm. We should maybe all have a chart on our table that has the food groups. And mm-hmm. we should probably talk about those on a regular basis at breakfast and dinner times and
whatnot.
That's
a good idea. I used mm-hmm. to do that actually with our 8-year-old when she was like 4 and 5. I had a little sticker chart for her, and it was, you know, did you eat food from all food groups today? And we had the food group pyramid there. Mm-hmm. And we would talk about it, you know, this is a grain and this is a protein. And I think candy or treats, or I like to stay away from the word treats. I like to stay away from the word using food as a reward, because we actually don't advise that ever. Mm-hmm. But I think we should put like candy as a food group, because for kids, it is a food group. And
absolutely,
we shouldn't, you know, make it so negative that it can't even be included on that pyramid. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when we, you know, with our 3-year-old now, when, and even our almost 2-year-old, when she comes and says, Mama, candy, and she hasn't even had breakfast yet, my concern is I don't want their tummies getting full on simple carbs, or whatever they're mm-hmm. called.
You don't want them getting full of garbage. Hungry. I mean, it's garbage.
I just know they're going to be hungry in like 10 more minutes, and I'm going to be leaving for work, and I'm not going to be able to cook a meal at that time. Mm-hmm. So they kind of just have to eat when it's convenient for me right now, right? And so,
but we also know it's not the best ingredients too. We want them to have the best ingredients for their three major meals and whatnot, and a couple of good snacks. So we yep. should just say, We can definitely enjoy some candy or some ice cream after breakfast. First, let's go ahead and try these different food groups and let's get a little variety.
Yes.
And then we can all enjoy a piece of candy or some ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that that way of approaching it, because my mind went directly to variety and explaining why to the kiddos, like, okay, candy's candy. However, let's try to eat a variety of different food groups. And I like the idea, like having that educational tool at the table from a non-judgmental zone or stance. I think that's probably the most important thing. There's a difference between educating and then putting down certain foods, right? You don't have to put down candy in front of a kiddo, but you could say like, hey, let's try to eat this and this for breakfast and let's start with that. I will tell you that kids are pretty intuitive. They haven't had the lifespan to be corrupted by our society and what we should or shouldn't do and feel around food. So they may put down the candy if they're full on eating their pancakes and fruit. Yes. And my kiddo who's three, that child loves chocolate and he will eat chocolate all the time. That's fine. Chocolate's actually on my list of
it's foods. Cacao.
Dark chocolate,
he
right?
Likes dark chocolate, yes, the more cacao, he likes it.
That's cocoa for those who don't remember from the beginning of the show.
Cocoa. But I think it's, you know, allowing them to not have that. If that's something, like, he can put down a cookie if he doesn't want it or say, no, mom, I really don't want it today.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, if you think about it as adults, that's pretty hard. We don't see that very often. Yeah. If there's a cookie, we're going to eat it.
Right. And we're going to eat all of it, even if we're full.
Yes.
And if somebody brings dinner to the office, even though we're on a diet, we always end up eating one or 10.
Yes. And then we feel guilty.
Yeah.
And then that doesn't help us. And then we diet again. And then we feel guilty.
And you know, and that really happens too, because we didn't eat breakfast because we're rushing around and we don't eat breakfast. If we had our healthy breakfast with our variety of food groups that's on our table, then we probably wouldn't have indulged in that 10 donuts or whatnot, and we would be in better shape. So it's starting off with a healthy breakfast, variety of foods. And when we do that, we succeed. And when we teach our kids that, and I love the thing about the chart, and I love the thing about, let's talk about this is fuel.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go outside and play today? Of course. You want to go swimming today? Yes. You want to go ride bikes later on? Okay, let's do it.
You want to go to gymnastics practice later?
We have to have the fuel, and these foods provide fuel. So let's have some fun in that variety, the color. You know, what color is this food? Okay, could you show me how you eat purple? You know, and, you know, and even as they get older, you can still have fun with it in other ways.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Anything else you want to tell us about the brain gut access? Are there any like foods or supplements or vitamins that people should be trying to focus on to help with their mental health?
So to summarize that, yes. So typically polyphenols or plant-based foods, like fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, even things like beans, edamame, usually those are also high in fiber, which can help the gut as well. We think fiber helps make us poop. It does build the good bacteria in our gut too. It's just, it improves the health of our gut. So it makes sense. I forgot to mention before that foods that are typically high in omega-3s. So things like olive oils, fish, again, nuts and seeds. And then dairy products like yogurts or kefirs, cults that have probiotics and prebiotics in them. And then let's see, we've all heard that turkey makes us like tired. Well, it's called tryptophan. So things like turkey, even chicken, I think
what'd
I've
you call
seen.
Me?
He always does that.
Chicken. Oh, you call me a turkey.
I know. I was going to say turkey. Tryptophan, which is a precursor to serotonin, which 80% of it is made in our gut, can help our gut health. So if you notice a theme, there wasn't one particular food that is magic.
Yeah.
It is a variety of things, and it's a variety of food groups. It is not saying no to certain things or a detox juice.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
It's very helpful.
All right, so I got to ask you one last question now, and I promise this will be the last one, and this is going to be a short, easy answer. It's probably going to be like, well, I don't know. That depends. So I'm going to answer for myself. But since you are the expert, you mentioned vitamins. I've always really questioned vitamins because when I buy my vitamins, there's like 2,000% of this, 1,500% of this. I'm like, there's no way my body is going to take all this stuff, and it's just going to go away. So
yeah.
How good really are vitamins? I know like when a woman's pregnant, prenatal vitamins and postnatal, because their body is doing more work than normal and whatnot. But for a normal person like me, and I'm not really that normal, but we'll just say I'm normal, the vitamins really help me. Or if I'm eating healthy, especially, and eating regular, do I really need vitamins?
You can get all of the nutrients that you need, with the exception of vitamin D, from the foods that you eat.
And if I drink a lot of milk, then I get my vitamin D?
Not enough.
Okay.
So
you
that's
need sunshine for
what
that.
What about iron? You want my sunshine, baby.
Usually, if you eat meat and you do eat vegetables and fruits, then you're going to be okay with iron, unless you have a medical condition that is more susceptible to anemia. And that also involves B12. Obviously, when we talk about like vegetarians and vegans and things like that, you're missing parts of your diet. So then you have to reevaluate, are you getting the nutrients that you need? But all in all, you can get what you need from food when you eat a variety. Now, kids, if we don't, I mean, it's hard for kids to eat a variety of foods, especially vegetables. You know, a vitamin can provide a supplement, fill in the gaps, but ideally you can get everything that you need from food, and so can kids.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I promise no more questions. We appreciate you being on the show today and all the expertise you provided us. We are looking forward to having you back in the near future. So
yes.
Thanks for joining the Parents Survival Kit, from surviving to thriving on your dinner at your dinner table. We'll see you next week.